Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 92. I do hope you're all keeping well. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's so lovely to have your company. As always, I'd like to begin by acknowledging and thanking the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast via Podbean Patron, and extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. Your support is very much appreciated. If you love the podcast and never miss an episode, perhaps you'd consider becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family, and in addition to receiving lots of Tudor-themed goodies, you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. November's prize is a copy of The Birth of a Queen, essays on the quincentenary of Mary I, edited by Sarah Duncan and Valerie Schutte. A huge thank you to Valerie for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm delighted that joining me on the show to talk about Tudor neuroscience is Dr. Christina Faraday. Dr. Faraday is a historian of art and ideas specialising in Tudor England. She's a research fellow at Gonville and Caius College, Cambridge, and an affiliated lecturer in history of the art at the University of Cambridge. In 2019, she was chosen as one of 10 AHRC BBC New Generation Thinkers, a scheme which gives early career researchers the opportunity to share their research on BBC Radio 3 and other platforms. From 2017 to 2019, she worked part-time as a curatorial intern on the National Portrait Gallery London exhibition, Elizabethan Treasures, Miniatures by Hilliard and Oliver. Her PhD explored liveliness in Tudor art, asking how Tudor artists made their work vivid and immediate for contemporary viewers. Her next project considers the relationships between visual art and music in Elizabethan England. My conversation with Christina straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Christina. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Natalie. Thanks for having me.
So maybe let's begin by you just introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us a little bit about your background.
Well, I'm Dr. Christina Faraday, and I'm a research fellow in history of art at Gonville and Caius College, the University of Cambridge. And my research focuses on the art and ideas of the Tudor period and how those things interact. So I guess I first studied the Tudors at school, and they crop up a lot in the English curriculum. I think most people probably were like, oh no, not the Tudors again. But I loved it and I couldn't get enough of it. And when I came to Cambridge to study history of art as an undergrad, there was a Tudor art course and things kind of escalated from there. So I ended up doing my PhD on liveliness in Tudor art, identifying the techniques that artists used to make artworks vivid and powerful for viewers at the time. And now my research project is looking at the relationship between art and music at the Elizabethan court.
Now, the topic for today's talk, though, is actually Tudor neuroscience, which I'm just so excited about. And so basically, we're going to be talking about what Tudor people thought went on in the brain, which is, I think, something we really don't hear about too often. So I suppose a good place to start is, how did people actually study the brain at this time?
Well, in the 16th century, the study of anatomy is starting to resemble its modern form for the first time in the West. Until that point, physicians had mainly relied on classical authorities such as Galen, who believed that the body contained substances called the humours. So there are four of them. There's blood, black bile, yellow bile, and phlegm. And depending on your kind of nature, your temperament, you would already have an excess of one of them. So if you're melancholic, it was because you had an excess of black bile. And any disease could be caused by an imbalance of humours. So it's quite a sort of strange to us, an old-fashioned sounding approach to medicine. Anatomy lectures did use real cadavers in the Middle Ages. They did use real dead bodies, but usually to demonstrate the ideas in classical texts. They weren't really using them to find out what went on in the body. They were using them to show that Galen was right. And this changes in a big way in the 16th century. You get the Flemish physician Andrea Vesalius. And he uses the body as a tool for research. So he's not just demonstrating the ancient authorities, he's actually questioning them and saying, well, hang on a minute, this doesn't make sense. And he completely overhauls our understanding of the body. His beautiful anatomy textbooks are translated and they're pirated in many different languages. They even make it into English in the middle of the 16th century, although it's not very clear that the publisher, who was called Thomas Gemini, really understood the significance of what Vesalius was doing, because he replaced Vesalius's text, which explained the diagrams, with a much older Galenic account of the body's working. So he's still kind of stuck in that classical mode. So this is a period when the first steps really are being taken towards some modern understandings of the body, but a lot of medical ideas about how the body worked were still quite old-fashioned. So it wasn't until the 17th century that William Harvey figured out the true function of the heart and how blood actually circulated. And that's also true of their ideas about the mind, which were essentially inherited from Aristotle.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those prominent ideas about the structure of the brain and the mind at the time, and also how they thought that the senses process things.
So the model of the mind that had the most currency in Tudor England was ultimately Aristotelian, but it had undergone some alterations in the Middle Ages. And there are various conflicting accounts of what happens in the mind, so authors don't really agree. So I'm going to give you an idea of the general features of most of these accounts, but each account kind of gives different jobs to different parts of the mind and things like that. But basically, the brain had five ventricles or faculties. And everything starts at the front of the brain in the ventricle called the common sense. And this is where the mind receives impressions from the senses, and that's where they enter the brain. So different inputs from your eyes, from your nose, from your sense of touch, these combine and create a mental image of the thing that you're perceiving. But the problem with the common sense is it's really watery. It can't hold on to sense impressions for very long. It's like putting your hand in the bath. The handprint doesn't stay there. So the images from the common sense get passed very quickly into the next ventricle, which was called the imagination. And the imagination is where images can be divided and recombined to create new images. And it's thanks to the imagination that we can actually picture things we've never perceived. So for example, a golden mountain. You've seen gold, you've seen a mountain, but you've never seen a golden mountain, but you can kind of take the goldness of gold and the mountainness of mountain and still kind of create yourself a mental image. They also thought that when we sleep, the imagination is the thing that stays active on its own, randomly recombining the thoughts that we have to make dreams. But when we're awake, the imagination passes the images that it's made and sort of compared onto a third faculty called the estimation. And the estimation judges and extracts meaning from the images. So if the imagination gives it a picture of a wolf, the estimation will look at that and extract the meaning that this could be dangerous. And the meaning is known as the image's intention, the meaning that it has to the person perceiving it. But the estimation doesn't have any role in deciding. That's all down to the fourth ventricle called the cogitation. So the estimation passes that information along again. And there the cogitation, that's where the soul sits. And that's where decisions are made about the action and how you respond to what you're seeing. So we've seen a wolf. The imagination has maybe compared parts of the wolf with other things that you've seen, the big eyes, the sharp teeth. And the estimation has looked at this information, decided, okay, this could be dangerous. And then the cogitation takes all of that and it goes, maybe we should run away from this wolf. So that's how you make a decision. But because we're imperfect beings, our cogitation isn't perfectly rational. And it can be affected by things called the appetites, so hunger or desire. And your ultimate decision is based on the degree to which the will and the appetite agree on what's most beneficial.
Now, I have heard you talk about this subject before, and I was fascinated to hear about something called a worm. Can you tell us about the worm?
The worm is a very important part of the brain, according to the Tudors. The worm controls access to the fifth and the final ventricle, which was the memory. And the memory is at the back of the head. And they said it's obviously at the back of the head because people who get head injuries to the back of the head have trouble remembering things. So that makes sense. And diagrams of the mind from medieval manuscripts show an actual worm nestled. It's called the worm nestled between the cogitation and the memory. And the worm controls the flow of thoughts between the storehouse of the memory and the kind of active part of the brain. And the worm tilts depending on whether you're memorizing something, in which case thoughts are flowing back into the memory, or if you're remembering something, in which case thoughts flow out of the memory. And at the time, people thought this was a really good explanation for why when you're trying to remember something, you tilt your head forward and you put your head in your hand, because it's helping the flow of thoughts come from the memory back into the active part of the brain. It helps the worm.
Love the worm. And I love their logic as well. And it's funny because we still do it, don't we? We're trying to think of something, you do tilt your head forward. So it's the worm, everybody. Just remember that. And what about thought? How did thought happen according to the Tudors?
Well, thinking for them depends on a system of mental images. So regardless of whether the thought originated in a word that you read or an actual thing that you saw or a picture that you saw, once it gets into the brain, all thoughts are mental images. And this has really important implications for Tudor culture, because very vivid and visual words and actual images are more powerful than everyday words. They're more memorable. They affect you more powerfully. They had a head start on the visualizing process, which enables the mind to process them as thoughts. They're already kind of playing into that system of mental images.
Let's say you're a Tudor person and you've looked at something, say a portrait or a tapestry. How does that process work?
Well, I already mentioned that different authors have different ideas about what happens in each part of the mind. But this is nothing compared with the disagreements over how sense perceptions actually get into the mind in the first place. And this is particularly true of the sense of sight. So there are two competing theories, basically. There's extramission theory. And in extramission theory, you have beams shooting out of your eyes to touch objects and then returning to your eyes with the information. And Shakespeare talks a lot about eye beams or light coming from the eye in his sonnets. And he's referring to this very common explanation for sight. But the alternative theory, which people couldn't really agree on, was intromission theory. And that's where particles are constantly streaming off objects and entering the eye that way. But critics of intromission theory questioned how it could be that objects were constantly giving off these particles, but never getting any smaller. So that's a good question. But in both these models, so regardless of which one you followed, the sense of sight was a physical connection with the thing that you were seeing. It had powerful, tangible implications for the power that sight had to affect the viewer.
Yes, and that's such an important point, isn't it? And we'll get to that more in a little bit. But so what superstitions did people have about the power of sight? Because we're talking about this physical connection. So what could it do to your mind if you looked at something?
Well, there's all sorts of superstitions that arise around this. So Aristotle, who we inherited a lot of these ideas from, for example, he thought that women could stain mirrors red if they looked at them during their periods. And apparently it's particularly really bad for new mirrors. You just can't get the stain out if it's a new mirror. If it's an old mirror, maybe you can kind of wipe it off, but not a new mirror. And it was also thought that you could be infected by a poisonous sight. And you get a reference to this in Shakespeare's Richard III, where Richard is starting to woo Anne at her husband's funeral. And Anne says, "Never hung poison on a fowler toad. Out of my sight thou dost infect mine eyes." And he says, "Thine eyes, sweet lady, have infected mine." So she's talking about poison, but he's talking about lust. And that was another theory about eye beams, that women's wanton eye beams, of course, it's always the women, would strike men and infect them with a sort of feeling of lust that they otherwise wouldn't have experienced. So that's how lust works. It also has powerful implications for pregnant women who were thought to be in danger of imprinting the things that they saw around them onto their unborn fetus. And this could take the form of a birthmark, but it could also be more extreme. So in one sermon in the 16th century, Martin Luther, the man who set the Protestant Reformation in motion, refers just kind of casually in passing to a woman that they've all heard about who had recently given birth to a mouse, having been startled by one during her pregnancy. And the way he introduces this is just like, we all know about the woman who recently gave birth to a mouse. So, you know, this was a really, it wasn't just a sort of fringe belief. It was something that they really felt could happen. And they didn't blame the women that this happened to. It was just a kind of physiological process. And it's also an explanation given for black babies being born to white parents and vice versa. So the idea that the wife had been looking at a picture of someone of a different colour at the moment of conception, and then that had affected the baby in the womb.
Right. I have to say that was so eye-opening for me when I first heard you discuss that, because I thought with the, obviously when Tudor women went into their confinement, you know, I knew that it was a very cocoon-like environment with the tapestries and everything covered, and that the tapestries should be, you know, kind of nice images. And I just thought that was to not upset the person. I didn't realize that there was this actual belief in this physical connection and link with, you know, if you've got the big war tapestries up or something like that, that it could, of course, yeah, imprint itself.
Exactly. Yeah, you don't want to be seeing anything upsetting or even kind of remarkable during your pregnancy. It's got to be quite soft and plain and probably really boring.
Yeah, I wonder if that caused a bit of anxiety, because I'm just thinking if that was my belief and I was pregnant, I'd just be so sort of worried about what I was looking at.
Well, exactly. I just feel, you know, pregnancy must have been a scary enough time at a time when so many women died in childbirth. And to have the added pressure of not turning your baby into a mouse.
Yeah, that's right. I know, that's incredible. All right, so how can an understanding of this Tudor model of the mind help us understand how Tudors use language? You've already touched on that a little bit with the sort of power of it, but how they use language and art, I think that's a really interesting sort of area to look at.
Well, Tudors were really invested in the use of art for moral and didactic purposes. And we have examples of this. Erasmus, the Dutch humanist, whose theoretical works on education were very influential in Tudor England, he recommends using paintings and tapestries to teach children. So there's already this sense of kind of using the visual environment to teach. But more specifically, there are lots of references to the idea that seeing a portrait can inculcate virtue in the viewer. So in Thomas More's Utopia, published in Latin in 1516, he refers to the inhabitants of his imaginary island putting up statues of people so that the glory and renown of the ancestors may stir and provoke their posterity to virtue. And we get the same kind of thing about 50 years later in 1563, when Lawrence Humphrey in The Nobles, or Of Nobility, describes the custom of displaying portraits of nobility. And he says that you do this, that children might gaze on the images and titles of their ancestors and not only read their virtues, but learn to counterfeit them. So in those texts, the pictures are mainly seem to be working as reminders. You see the picture and you consciously think, I should be more like my virtuous great-grandfather or whatever. But then there are other references which suggest a kind of mystical understanding of the influence that portraits could have. So Henry Wotton, for example, the author and diplomat, refers to the secret and strong influence exerted by continual representation of virtuous examples, he means of people, in the form of marble monuments and memories of well-deserving men in ancient times. And he actually puts this into practice. He's a schoolmaster at Eton in 1620, where he attaches portraits of the worthies, so usually classical figures of good reputation, and he puts them on the columns in the lower school at Eton. And you can still see the columns, although not the portraits, in Eton today. So it may be that this idea that portraits could exert a kind of moral influence on their viewers, whether consciously or unconsciously, helps to explain the popularity of portrait galleries in Tudor England. And obviously they were spaces for entertaining and education and exercise, and you'd often see portraits of your ancestors or famous figures there. But if we put that in context with the Tudor ideas about the mind, where sight is this tangible connection, these portraits are sort of physically penetrating the mind and exerting a really powerful influence on the moral character of the people who use those spaces.
That's so interesting. And I'm just thinking, you know, in terms of Henry VIII and his wives. So if we're thinking about Anne Boleyn, obviously when, you know, after her execution, Henry pretty much had all her images destroyed. And I'm wondering, what do you think? Do you think he thought that perhaps there was some, you know, way that she could get to him, you know, some physical link if he looked at her? Or do you think that was just, you know, him just trying to get rid of the reminder of her?
Well, I think that this is the thing, isn't it? That reminders have a very powerful impact in Tudor England, you know, and it is a physical thing. So even if he is just removing the reminders, it would still have been probably with a sense of the efficacy of a portrait in kind of reminding you or persuading you about someone's virtues or otherwise.
But I do have a question about why then would they have, because I know sometimes they had portraits of, say, Richard III. So why would you put a portrait up of someone that they would have considered to be a villain, an evil person? Why would they do that?
Well, that's a really good question. And we do, as you say, we do know that Tudor people had portraits of Richard III in their galleries, and several portraits of him survive. Usually when you get a portrait of Richard III, it's often part of a set of kings and queens. So there's a sort of completeness motivation, like he's part of the kind of English history thing. But we also know there was a portrait of Richard III at St. James's Palace, where Edward VI was brought up under the guardianship of his uncle, which is really weird. And we do know that Tudor writers allowed for this possibility that portraits could exert an evil as well as a good moral influence over their viewers. So in Samuel Purchas's book, London Parson, which was actually written slightly after the Tudor period, 1626, but still kind of dealing with the same ideas, he describes the Ottoman Emperor Selim leaving his son Suleiman a legacy of, quote, bloodshed and desolation to the Christians, but to excite him thereunto had left him the lively counterfeit of himself with sundry bloody precepts annexed. So this idea that this portrait is kind of used to encourage Suleiman to sort of, in Tudor eyes, do terrible things to Christians. In Edward VI's case, I think we can be pretty sure they weren't trying to turn him into Richard III. I don't think that would have been a very important motivation for them. So I think in this case, it's probably a negative moral exemplar. It's something to avoid. In Tudor eyes, Richard III was an example of tyranny, of lust for power, a murderous instinct even. But there's still something quite odd about that, because Edward VI was effectively in the same position as the princes in the Tower, who had died only 50 years earlier in mysterious circumstances. So that's the equivalent of something happening in the 70s for us. You know, it's really recent. And he's another king, he's called Edward, he's in his minority, and his uncle is acting as Lord Protector. So what I want to know is whether that portrait of Richard III could have introduced a slightly subversive element into Edward's education. You know, was it a sort of reminder about an uncle who met a sticky end when he didn't treat his nephews right? Is it maybe a reminder to Lord Somerset to behave himself and to not kind of behave as Richard did? But we don't know. Obviously, we don't know how Edward would have seen that picture. But we do know that thanks to Tudor ideas about the structure of the mind, it would have been seen as a very effective moral tool in the education of Edward and the other children being brought up then.
Fascinating. I don't think I'll ever look at any portrait the same way. I'm just going to be analysing everything via the Tudor, you know, beliefs of the mind. So thank you so much for sharing all that wonderful, wonderful stuff. Now, at the end of our episodes, Christina, I like to play a little game that I call 10 to go. So just 10 questions to get to know our guests a little bit better. So what was your first job?
My first job was working in the bookshop in my hometown. It's an independent bookshop called David's Bookshop. It's still going. It's an amazing bookshop. If you come from England or you're in the Hertfordshire area, definitely pay them a visit when our lockdown lifts. It was a really fun job, and being around all those books all the time was just lovely.
Yeah, that does sound like a dream, actually. So what was your favourite subject at school?
It was actually history, which is a very boring answer in this topic. I mean, I loved pretty much all subjects except for PE, but history, I couldn't wait for my history lessons. Basically, I was a real nerd.
Wow, still am. I love it. Now, I was going to ask you what your favorite form of exercise is, but I'm not sure.
Oh, I know. It's okay now.
Oh, okay.
I got into yoga at the start of the year, which was great actually, because it was something I could do when we were all stuck inside. And it's a nice way of moving without, I've tried running and I'm obviously not meant to be a runner, but yoga is nice.
Yeah, it's lovely, and a lovely way to relax too. So obviously you love, you know, Tudor art as well. Do you have a favorite 16th century portrait? Oh, one of your favourites. You've probably got so many.
Okay, I'm a really big fan of Christopher Hatton, who was one of Elizabeth's favourites, and he's my favourite. And there's a really weird portrait of him in the National Portrait Gallery in London, which is like an astrological portrait. So it has his kind of birth date and then sort of little figures of like a painter and an astrologer. And it's double-sided. So on the other side, it's got a figure of Father Time. And it was obviously meant to be sort of in a doorway or something, so you could see both sides. But it's such an unusual picture, and he's someone I'm hoping to work on more, because every painting, every artwork that's associated with him is just so wacky, and he's just doing some really unusual stuff. I think he's a really interesting figure.
I can't picture that one. So I'm going to have to, as soon as we're done, I'm going to go and do a little Googling so I can find that one. Because double-sided, that's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really unusual. No, it's not. And it's such a, you know, Tudor portraits often have very dark backgrounds, and, you know, they can be quite somber in appearance. And this has just like colours and circles, and like, it's really fun.
All right, fabulous. Something for us all to look at. All right, so what type of music do you enjoy?
I actually have very eclectic music tastes. I listen to a lot of folk. My parents are classical musicians, so I've grown up with a lot of classical music. And I've recently got into Taylor Swift, which I wasn't expecting, but, you know, everything really.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. And what about an inspirational place that you like to visit that's close to your home?
When I was a teenager, we went a lot to a village in Bedfordshire called Old Warden, which has the Shuttleworth collection, which is a collection of very old aeroplanes, sort of like there's a triplane from sort of the very early 20th century. And it also has an area called the Swiss Garden, which was, I think, also sort of built in the 20th centuries. And it's just this amazingly kind of peaceful, beautiful place. They've got peacocks, and it just kind of reminds me very much of family trips when I was a teenager, and just a space that I could go and be kind of learn stuff, but also be peaceful and happy.
And so when you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be an actress for a very long time. And then when I was a teenager, I realised I wasn't very good at acting because I'm a bit too kind of honest. I wasn't very good at pretending. But what I did find, the kind of element of performing and a lot of the time making people laugh, I could kind of do in lectures. So I think probably that's where I've channeled that. I still get to stand in front of an audience, but I don't have to pretend I am really this excited about Tudor art.
So if you were stranded on a deserted island, who would you like to be there with? And you can pick from any period of history that you like, or even contemporary, up to you.
Oh, it's such a risk, isn't it? Because what if they turn out to be awful?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right.
I just have to choose someone I think would tell really interesting stories. Mm-hmm. Or someone, you know what? I'd like to be there with Lavina Tierlink, who is a really... So not much is known about her. She's a very well-paid mid-Tudor artist who worked for Edward and Mary and Elizabeth. And we don't really know anything about her life. So maybe while I'm on the desert island, I can take a few notes and finally kind of find out who trained her and how did she know Nicholas Hilliard and all those questions that we don't know the answer to.
Absolutely, that sounds good. And what has 2020 taught you?
I think I've learned quite a lot about myself in 2020 and the kinds of situation, the kind of environment I need to really focus on different types of projects. So I found that when I'm quite distracted, I can make myself focus for short periods of time on short-term projects, but anything long-term, I need to kind of really try to settle my mind before I attempt it. It's hard to see the end point, isn't it, sometimes?
Very last thing, Christina, is a Tudor takeaway. So I ask all my guests for a little something for us to go and have a look at after the episode. You've already given us that wonderful portrait of Christopher Haddon that we're all going to go and search up. But did you have another suggestion for us?
I do. It's a TV series from 1970 called The Six Wives of Henry VIII. And perhaps another guest has previously mentioned this, but it's just one of my favourite representations of the Tudor period. It's beautifully filmed, beautifully acted, and each episode focuses on a different wife. And there's an amazing attention to detail, so particularly in the music, which was produced by David Monroe, and that had authentic instruments, and it kind of kick-started the revival of interest in early music. So it's interesting in that respect. But my favourite thing about it is the portrayal of Thomas Cromwell by Donald Pleasence. And he really captures the bulldoggishness that we can see in Holbein's famous portrait. So we get a sense of his lower social status. Donald Pleasence gives him a bit of a twang to his accent. So we really get a sense of his recent arrival at the top. And then when he falls from grace, the noblemen on the council, this isn't really a spoiler, but the noblemen on the council come and physically strip him of his chains of office, like they wrench them off him. And I've never seen another version of the Tudors which captures that kind of, you know, old money, new money, jealousy and snobbishness, which I don't think you get from the more kind of refined portrayals of Cromwell. You know, I think it's a really well-observed examination of the Tudors.
Do you remember who plays Henry VIII?
Keith Michell.
Of course, it's the Australian actor. I should have remembered that. But yeah, it's been a while. I haven't watched it in a long time. So there you go, something for us to do. And if you're in the UK and spending a bit of time indoors at the moment, you've got something to pass the time with. Well, Christina, this has been so wonderful. I really feel like I've learned a lot and that you've given us a lot of food for thought and something that we don't often discuss and hear about. So thank you so much for talking Tudors with me.
Thank you.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is on the Tudor Trail and on Instagram as the Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.